Hello and welcome to Wax Lyrical, the advertising podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society, and I'm Mark.
I'm Karen.
Hi, and I'm Paul.
And in this episode, we'll be talking about London centricity. Actually, the drawbacks that it might be causing for our creative industries. We'll be debunking all of those fibs about the direct-to-consumer market and looking at some new campaigns from Celebrity Cruises, Expedia and Oatly. So here we are, sitting in almost the very centre of the very centre of the capital city. If you've never looked around our offices, we are on New Oxford Street, just a mere stone's throw away from Tottenham Court Road. So the heart of our retail world. And there's so much going on in the news at the time of our recording about how we mustn't be so London-centric. Our new Prime Minister is threatening to move the House of Lords to York. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, there, and you know, everybody has said that he won the election because of unusually high support from behind that red wall. So all of the northern powerhouse cities that would normally vote Labour actually voted Conservative. And a week or so ago in the Sunday Times, the leaders of those authorities, the mayors or the local councils, all wrote a letter in the Sunday Times saying, you must not abandon HS2. You must continue with your promise to connect the north with each other. I don't know whether you know, but the HS2 is like a Y-shaped thing. It goes up from London to Birmingham and then goes into a Y to Leeds and to Manchester. And they're talking about connecting the top between Hull and Leeds as well, I think. So, and anywhere between, I think, 80 billion, and I've forgotten the numbers. They're just kind of off the scale. But at the time of recording, it is under threat. And Karen, you and I were standing in Euston the other day, and they've already put the hoardings up and everything, saying this is going to be HS2 and stuff. So there'll be a lot of people whose noses are put out of joint if HS2 doesn't happen. And if it doesn't happen, the London centricity that we are accused of, I think, will get only worse. But yeah, my hypothesis, Karen, is that it makes us weaker. Mm-hmm. We are not as informed, as connected. I mean that more emotionally than I do mean physically, but obviously the physical connection is important. We're not as connected as we could be because we're sitting here in London. As I said, we are the epitome of the ivory tower, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as an industry, we're supposed to have our finger on the pulse of people and attitudes, and how can we really do that when we live in a London bubble, which is, I think, a very real thing. I think our exposure to the world is very different to the rest of the UK, or at least parts of the UK.
It is, and certainly for advertising, we see a very, very distinct view of kind of what advertising is. And you see a brand and you think, we'll get on to talk about a couple of them today, but you see a brand and you assume it's a national campaign. It probably is, but what's actually happening in London with that campaign, it would be very unique. And kind of, it's almost in an involuntary way, you're like that, you just start assuming that's what the rest of the country is seeing or behaving or absorbing that in the same way. So our influences from other advertisers as advertising people, if that's not too confusing, will completely shape how we do it.
Yeah, I think without doubt we are living in an echo chamber. So not are we existing, because we used to talk about the fact that, you know, we only connected electronically with people of like minds. We're literally only seeing stuff made by people of like minds. And that worries me. And linked to that, I wonder, what kind of people do you think our industry attracts and retains in London versus if our business wasn't in London? Do you think there is a different kind of London creative person versus a creative person outside London?
I wouldn't say it's that simple, but maybe as a broad brushstroke, yes. Like, whether it's, as I said, a person that's like chosen to move to London and take on all those extra costs, whether it's slightly more of a risk taker, I suppose, is all very, very, very generalised. But yes, I suppose there would be.
Okay, I'll tell you what I think. I think we're more aggressive in London.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
There's definitely a level of arrogance for sure, which is probably the most worrying thing, I think, which is you do need ego and arrogance within creativity to a certain degree, but then that doesn't fit with relating or connecting with people that aren't like you. And let's not forget, a lot of our briefs will be for people that aren't like us, whether that's just a purely demographic thing or a socioeconomic. So that's probably the biggest challenge. How do you make sure you connect and relate? And some people will be very good at it.
And if that's correct, then I wonder if we are creating a creative tone that is unique to London. And the word you used, Kieran, was cynical. Do you think that we are more cynical in London, and that the work that we're producing comes from that? It may not be immediately obvious, but if you were able to distill a lot of the work that you see, is there a more cynical tone to the work that we're doing?
Yeah, I was thinking about it. Maybe cynical's not actually the right word, but and I wonder if this is also effect of the double bubble, advertising plus London. Ooh. In terms of
wow,
yes,
soundbite city.
Yes, I know.
Hey, by the way, we coined the Boris Bounce.
Okay, I've been using you that
heard
a lot.
It
I've been
here.
Using that a lot, actually.
You heard that, and this was back in November.
That's gone
anyway,
into the
I'm
pubs, that is.
Just
yeah,
saying.
I expect a Boris Bounce.
Okay. Yeah. Saying.
I wonder if we are too aware in terms of the type of advertising that we're creating. I think we make assumptions about our audience anyway, and how they feel about advertising, and how much they care about advertising, and how much attention they pay to advertising. And then on top of that, we have a London skew in terms of people's experience of the world and what we expect that to be. And I think that does impact on how we say things and the type of tone that we use. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily an accurate reading on a broader audience.
All this said, though, I think there are many ways in which, like I mentioned research, many ways in which I think we can, even though we sit within the doobly bubble, we can solve this. And Mark, looking at you, really, I think more I think we've talked about this before, but the planning community, about how they can use, whether it's tools or...
But yeah, I mean, obviously it's the planner's job to represent the voice of the consumer, so it's my community that should be immersed in it. And you remind me of something I heard Rory Sutherland say. I think he was presenting the latest round of the IPA's Touchpoints research, and I'm going to paraphrase it really badly, Rory, if you're listening, so forgive me, but he basically said, we're going to show you some research, and honestly, it's a bit dull, because it's about the real world. And you guys and girls sitting in London, you're always striving to find the spikiest consumer insight so that you can create some really wacky creative. But I'm about to do some PowerPoint that tells you that the UK consumer is actually a bit dull. Mm. But that's the reality of the world that we live in. And or he might have said, and I'm going to show you some research, actually you probably can guess. You know, so later when we talk about a category, I'm going to tell you some stuff about that category that is not shocking. And maybe that's the tension, as planners not to say that we face. So the real consumer that I'm looking at is not that exciting.
Yeah.
But in order to stimulate my creative colleagues to do great work, I've got to find this thing that is really unusual. And it may not actually be representative of our audience. And that's how we create this creativity that's in London, where we do have, you know, the flotsam and jetsam of society, you know, every kind of person you see walking down Oxford Street, obviously. And we think that the rest of the world is like that, and it probably isn't.
Mind the gap. Mind the gap.
One leitmotif that runs through the podcast is we're normally big fans of Mark Ritson. And I have to say, I'd still, if I had the time, love to do his MBA. Not a plug, Mark, if you're listening, but one of our colleagues is doing it at the moment and speaks very highly of it. Also, probably I'm betraying my own insecurities as not having higher education. But nevertheless, there was a column he wrote quite a few weeks ago now that we have continued to debate, and I thought we'd share that debate with you today. He wrote a rather damning piece about the direct-to-consumer category, and I don't know why he was angry. Do you think somebody
he was
had
very
somebody,
angry.
Somebody upset him? Maybe he'd invested? Or maybe, I tell you what, he'd probably be really angry because he failed to invest. That is why.
Sour grapes.
Sour grapes. drapes, I think. So, Mr. Ritson, I have utmost respect for you, but I actually do want to have a chat with you about the direct-to-consumer category, because I think it is not as bad as you have painted it. Mm. I think he was probably having a bad news week.
Yeah, and
he
straw that break the camel's break back or something.
He's having a bad news week, and he thought, oh, I'll rip them a shred.
Well, he's being purposely provocative.
Waiting for us to, kind of argue back, obviously. Yeah.
Which we'll do with pleasure.
Yeah. and so we're doing it with our tongue firmly in our cheeks, Mark. They never set out to be a new marketing model, did they, we think? Well, what do we think they were setting out to be when it started?
Well, that is... it's part of the argument in the article, is that the D2C category set out to revolutionize the marketing approach and are quickly and humbly realizing that traditional marketing approach works for a reason and they have to revert back to it. So they cannot revolutionize the marketing approach. But I don't necessarily think that's what D2C or even, let's call them broadly, new tech businesses set out to do. I think that they look to revolutionize the categories they're in or revolutionize business models. Might still need some work on that. Ritson talks a lot about how a lot of these businesses struggle to achieve profitability. Valid concern, which we can talk about.
Yeah.
But I think their marketing model is more influenced on a needs must basis. A lot of them won't have huge investment to make in marketing, and they have to achieve scale before it's worth investing in marketing.
Yeah, it's definitely not a new model. Would you think it's fair to say that they're using existing channels, primarily digital, but trying to do it in a different way? I think that, like, as in they've endeavoured to try and do things a little bit differently, but I wouldn't say that's a new using new channels.
Well, it's not. Can I just wind back a bit, first of all? And I know Mark didn't mean this, but he created the impression that, let's say it's us, you know, sitting in your kitchen, Karen, and we're coming up with an idea. And the first idea we came up with was, let's create a new category. Forget the business. We're going to create a new category, and we're going to call it direct to consumer. Actually, Mr. Ritson, I think you did that, or your colleagues did. Your journalistic colleagues decided to bunch these new entrepreneurs together and call them direct to consumer. I don't think any entrepreneurs decided to create a new marketing model. I think some entrepreneurs decided to go, what can we do that makes money that actually serves a consumer need?
Exactly.
And come on, we know we've got some friends who've done this, and actually they were just taking old-fashioned direct marketing and bringing it up to date by using the channels that were then available, as you just started to say, Paul, by using digital channels. And you're a startup, so because this did create a thing and they were able to get money, some of them did go bigger with their spending. But when it was their own money, back to us three round our kitchen table, when it's our own money, we'll go, well, what can we do that's not a lot of money? We'll do whatever we can with Facebook and Instagram, and we'll do it ourselves. And then later on in the article, he gets a bit out of shape about influencers. Well, I would have done the same, because if I've got a mate whose mate is an influencer, I'd go, hey, if I give you this, will you just say my product's amazing, please? Thanks.
Yeah, I think.
Why wouldn't I do that?
It's a bit of a hustle in the beginning.
Lovely. I love that. You got to hustle. Yeah.
You're right about D2C though. It's kind of like in jargon terms, it's like the horizontal definition of all these brands, but they all sit in their own right within verticals. It's tech or like travel, and I think similar to the way in which they've marketed, they're not really creating new categories. They're finding existing sort of needs that are kind of, they sort of reframe them or find a different way to supply them, whether it's taxi services, we've always needed taxis, that kind of stuff, or the way you deliver your razors, you've always needed razors. So it's just kind of smart evolutions, I think, versus kind of anything revolutionary. I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and convenience is king, and that is certainly where they play.
Yes, completely. But yeah, there's some interesting stuff. He may be purposely provocative, as I said, or he's just quite angry. He sort of generalised a lot around who these entrepreneurs are, and I understand kind of part of it in that. Yeah, it is a shame on that many you won't hear of, and it's kind of that probably comes back to if it is. it isn't just young people, but those, if they've got the right guidance and counsel, that they can have the right business models in place. Because, you know, we know plenty of stories where there's exciting ideas that kind of have potential but don't have the right kind of smarts around it to make it happen. But for me personally, having started my own business as well, I'm like that's not passion, because in an economy that's pretty slow at the moment, you've got lots of people being brave and starting their own businesses. And yes, the reality at the moment is the ones that are successful do end up in traditional distribution models. Take Harry's, for example. They start out D2C, but then end up in Boots, because that's currently, I think, anyway, to get true scale is to be in bricks and mortar. That's just the reality. But those that do and work or don't work, like, for me, it's like, fair play. Like, the economy needs that to be stimulated. And we always talk just advertising, but it's not just that. Like, if there's a new D2C brand that starts up, it's going to have a distribution model. It's going to have products that need supplying, hopefully from UK factories or from tech developers, all that kind of stuff. It's stimulating way more than advertising. So I think it's unfair to bash those that aren't successful for whatever reason, because the economy needs it.
And I go back to my earlier point about my observation was it was direct marketers who were finding new ways to exploit their skills. He mentions data twice in his article, as in, and he doesn't say it, so I'm misrepresenting you, Mark, but it certainly hinted that it was almost like they one of their objectives was to gather data. We want data. Well, no, I go back to my earlier point. They were direct marketers, and obviously in order to fuel that particular discipline, you do need data. And as we were talking earlier about being London-centric, I do hear those founders, those entrepreneurs, being incredibly close to their customers. So it's not just the data that makes them close to their customers. They emotionally are. You know, they're looking at those comments on the emails they're getting and all that kind of stuff in a way that, for my generation, was unheard of. Mm. You've heard me talk about working with a CMO who used to go into the customer care department every Wednesday afternoon, which for me was an amazing thing. I mean, which in those days, CMOs didn't do that. They didn't talk to customers. Customers, I don't want to talk to customers. Keep me away from them. But these new D2C, and I'm using it again, people are close to their customers. Amazing. That means their NPD is instinctive as much as it is insightful. Well done, people, for doing that.
That said, though, if you were like a non-exec, if I was a non-exec for one of these businesses that were collecting data, then a long-term value prop for them would be that data.
And absolutely,
Look at Monzo's business plan that will be using their data to sell utilities or other stuff. So future value, which is again where that guidance may or may not help, is that you can think about what the future value of the business is once you undoubtedly get competition for your core offering, shall we say.
These extra furry creatures have trouble sleeping in the summer heat. Can they keep cool in our Casper mattress? Breathable foam, more air circulation. Looks like they're sleeping cool. Sleep cool, keep cool.
Let's talk about some work, and it's not a new ad, but it's certainly New Year, New You continues, and one of those new yous is the you you're taking on holiday, and not just any holiday, but on a cruise, and the cruise category is set to grow. I thought I'd share a bit of insight, and back to our point about London centricity and how real insight may be quite dull, then the most surprising thing I can tell you about the cruise category in the United Kingdom is that it's quite old. and we're laughing because the hype is that it's getting younger, but as of the last big cruise census, and there's like a trade body for the cruise category that looks at this, 74% of UK cruisers are aged over 50. The average age of a UK cruiser is 57, versus that same average age for the whole of Europe is 49, so considerably older in the UK. The reason that we have a lot of cruise advertising in this country is because at the moment it's relatively cost effective to target that audience, as you can imagine, because they've got a very clearly defined target audience. Not surprisingly, older consumers are more affluent. That is why the average value of a cruise in the UK for a couple is £3,500. And also, talking about direct-to-consumer, here's a category that absolutely should be changed. 95%
85% of cruise bookings are through a travel agent. And you guys know that that term is quite a broad one. You have a lot of digital travel agents these days. So don't think they're all popping down to Thomas Cook, because they've gone, by the way, everybody. They're now called Hayes, the few that are left, because the Hayes family bought most of the Thomas Cook shops.
They did,
and have relaunched them. In my hometown, there's a new... They literally put a plastic banner over the old Thomas Cook logo, and it just says Hayes Travel on it. And there's two women at two desks in a big empty shop that are hoping lots of people are going to come in. Anyway, 95% of cruise bookings are made through a travel agent. What's the world's biggest cruise line? You're looking at your notes, so you know. But did you know?
I did not know, no.
It begins with a C.
Is it Celebrity? Yeah. No, Carnival. Massive, isn't it? I mean, by comparison with the others, 12 million passengers Carnival carried. 12 million, that's a country.
Unbelievable.
That's a floating country. That is insane.
But yeah, we've got piece of creative for the cruise industry to show. I think, I don't know if you guys have seen much of it. I have. I've been exposed to quite a lot, even in linear TV, and much of it is the same. It's kind of I was surprised to see, maybe outside of kind of river cruises, a lot of it is kind of families with children, less of the sort of grey pound, as we call it.
It's interesting, isn't it, that that's a classic category where they really are portraying a consumer who isn't the actual consumer.
Yeah.
They're trying to debunk the myth that the cruisers are old. They are old. So Rory Sutherland alert, the consumer is a bit dull. He and she, they're couples and they're over 50.
Yeah, and I think you can see that.
That's mean.
But their marketing strategies seem quite consistent, which is growth area is families with children. Let's invest heavily, because we've got a decent amount of the over 50s already coming through. This one is an interesting one. It is for celebrity cruises, which is probably
they're number two in the world.
Probably those that stand out most for being quite vibrant and exciting, in not just the ships, but in terms of their work. And this is an ad from Lucky Generals, produced by Iconoclast, which are, they're both heavy hitters. It's called Wonder Awaits, and I think, as I said, a lot of the cruise advertising is quite similar, and you'd be forgiven for trying to identify who's who and what's what.
Do you think there is misattribution?
I think so, because it's kind of beautiful shots, logo. Kind of it. It's quite a blunt way of saying it, but that's kind of it. So I've picked this one out because it's very distinctive. I think it's still very much on a cruise ship in a holiday, but it's quite a kind of an alternative reality, shall we say.
What do we think it's about? The only thing I got was the soundtrack, which is aimed at my generation, Karen, because it's from the 70s, I think, but it's definitely White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah, good
which
knowledge.
Yeah, you've got to be a bit of a muso to know that. So soundtrack is aimed at my generation, but then, Paul, as you pointed out, the people in that ad are not my generation.
They're doing both, which is potentially very smart or a very happy
coincidence. Do I project myself as that lithe young woman who's lying on the sunbed? Whilst we're talking the holiday season, as it is, I think we all loved a press campaign by Expedia. And I'll give you a link to some stories about it. But it was basically a beautiful picture of the Canadian countryside with a lake in the foreground and some snow-capped mountains at the rear, and a search box, a Google-like search box in the middle, and somebody has typed in Canada, and underneath it the words "escape the family." And you know what this was referring to. It was Harry and Meghan, or as the American press call it, Megxit. And just real props to Expedia for having the courage to do something like this. Very, very cleverly done, quickly timed.
Well, you've missed the best bit, which is it's this week in the Evening Standard, next to a kind of 2/3 page article of said story, which is kind of it's one of
that
those things.
Is
you
message and media in perfect harmony.
You see it a couple of times a year, don't you? And you're like, it's so simple, it's beautiful, and you just kind of wonder, okay, how what's the conversation between kind of creative media and media owner to be like, we got this, need to be on the story, can we fit it in with your editorial? Yes, let's do this. Great, like. those conversations happening, the foresight. Yeah, very smart.
Fly Air Canada to a world of possibilities.
Continuing our theme of London centricity, one brand which claims to be moving out of London, having been very London centric, is Oatly. However, Oatly, if you're listening, we are seeing your ad everywhere in London, so I wonder if the reality is you are continuing in London but you're just waiting outside.
Well, we do know that Oatly, I think when they announced the campaign, part of the rationale behind it was, and I think they used to have a very heavy how can I say this, hipster London skew, so a lot of East London advertising, and I know they felt it was important to start to reach a broader audience.
Well, we love the Oatly campaign. I hope I can speak for all of us.
Absolutely,
I think very, very clever copy. I just wonder, back to our conversation, it's very inward looking.
It's very aware.
It's an ad campaign about an ad campaign, really.
Yeah.
And so we're guessing in London that would be so cool. But, you know, in Tamworth?
In London, it's everywhere. Yeah. I think I don't know how anyone could miss it. It's all over buses. It's in every tube station. They've got amazing digital out of home. And it is some really interesting contextual messaging. So an example being in Charing Cross Station on the ribbons. So the posters going up and down the escalators. On the one side, they have all the ribbons saying, we heard that if you read this on your way down, you would like it more. Oh, well. And then they've got the opposite on the other side. And then just really silly stuff like, if you take a photo of this ad and text it to someone who'll like it, or you actually read this ad, total success. It's just brilliant copywriting. It will definitely catch people's attention.
Yeah, I think sort of poking a bit of, as you said, Mark, an ad campaign about an ad campaign. So poking a bit of fun at us as an industry will always be well received. As Karen said, fantastic writing. But yeah, the contextual nature is, I think, for me, what makes it so great. That creative and context is bang on. They've obviously sat down and got a media plan or something like that in front of them and said, okay, right, this is what I'm writing to this. And that's, for us, our philosophy here is that an idea will reach its true potential by having those two coming together. And that's exactly what's happening here. And it's pretty generous. They're not just chucking out like a similar line everywhere. They've got, I've seen at least probably half a dozen.
There's lots of executions.
Different executions.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was very enjoyable for the creatives to work on, heavily invested in, so like credit to them, because it's a very dairy-free, meat-free noisy period, so they've definitely kind of risen to the top of those that are leading the march on that. But yeah, back to our first conversation on this pod is kind of what's happening in the rest of the country. It'd be interesting to know how much of investment is out there. And
so, if you're listening, particularly Alice Gosnell, who I think runs marketing for Oatly in the UK, and Michael Lee, who's the creative director over here, congratulations, we love the campaign. But most importantly, we'd like to know how it's doing. And we assume it's working really well in London, but based on that London centricity thing that we've been talking about, we wonder if it is working as well outside London. So we'd love to hear from you. And before we go, I've been meaning to mention for the past couple of episodes a thank you to the team at the Dogs Trust. And as this is audio, you can't hear, but this is Corky.
You can hear.
Well, you can. This is Corky. The lovely people at the Dogs Trust heard us talking about their kind of pre-Christmas campaign. And we rather arrogantly were saying, you know, you've missed a trick here. You should create a Corky. Here he is. I assume he's a he. I'll take a photo and put it in the podcast notes. But I think he was pre-Christmas. The idea was he was pre-Christmas
to go on your tree,
because he came in a little cardboard box, and as you take him out, he's kind of hanging on a piece of string. But Paul, you said he's not corky, is he? He's made out of a nice piece of wood.
I was hoping he was going to be made of recycled corks, but maybe that's a bit ambitious. Yeah,
it's cute though.
Very, very cute, and I hope to see it on your tree next Christmas, Mark.
A big thank you to Nicholas Daniel from the Dogs Trust, who organised all that. Corky is lovely. He has pride of place on my desk at the moment. Thank you. So sadly, that's all we've got time for this episode. Thank you very much. Looking forward to seeing you in a few weeks.
Bye.
Thanks, guys. Bye.